ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Feral horses trash, trample, degrade very sensitive alpine environments. There is no shortage of horses in Australia, but there is only a tiny slither of our country that is that precious alpine and subalpine environment.
They absolutely do have a value and deserve the recognition that they had. Unfortunately, they've decided to slaughter them based on false numbers, false science.
Wild horses in the New South Wales High Country will no longer be protected under law after legislation to repeal the controversial Kosciuszko Wild Horse Heritage Act passed New South Wales Parliament last night. We'll have more on what's been dubbed the Brumby Bill shortly. And caretakers at a remote luxury resort in the Kimberley relive their terrifying experience through Cyclone Fina.
It just felt like you're in your own apocalypse movie. Of course, all the alarms going off as well, just to add to it. So we knew there was damage, but we didn't expect what we saw there.
I'm Alex Hyman, and this is Australia Wide. We start in the New South Wales High Country. Laws recognising and protecting the heritage value of wild horses in the Kosciuszko National Park will be scrapped after legislation to repeal the controversial Kosciuszko Wild Horse Heritage Act passed New South Wales Parliament last night. Environmental groups have celebrated the demise of what's been labelled the Brumby Bill, while supporters of the horses are disappointed. Australia Wide reporter Lisa Herbert has more.
It's been a controversial and emotional issue for decades. For those who love these mountain horses, they're an important part of Alpine Australia's cultural heritage. But for others, they're simply an introduced species with hard hooves that damage the landscape. CEO of the Invasive Species Council, Jack Goff.
Feral horses trash, trample, degrade very sensitive alpine environments. There is no shortage of horses in Australia, but there is only a tiny slither of our country that is that precious alpine and subalpine environment.
Since 2018, wild horses in the Kosciuszko National Park in New South Wales have been legally protected under an Act of Parliament. The so-called Brumby Bill, introduced by former Deputy Premier and Nationals leader John Barilaro, recognised and protected the horse's role and value in Australia's heritage. The bill was opposed by environmentalists and conservationists at the time, who said it favoured an invasive species over the native environment. Independent member for Wagga Wagga, Joe McGurr, whose electorate includes parts of the New South Wales Snowy Mountains, introduced his own legislation to Parliament to repeal the Brumby Bill.
This was a situation where the evidence was pretty clear. The feral horses were destroying significant parts of a very precious environmental heritage, and we couldn't let that go on. You know, this hasn't been easy. We're not sort of kicking up our heels and rejoicing about this. This is really difficult stuff. You know, it's just one of the things that has to be done to manage our natural heritage.
Just before midnight last night, Mr. McGurr's bill to repeal the Brumbies protection passed Parliament with the support from Labor, Liberals, the Greens and Independents. He says it's long overdue.
As the numbers in the Parliament have reflected, the vast majority of Australians get this. They understand how people feel about the horses and the Brumbies. Of course they do, but they also understand that there's a balance here and we need to get back to getting that balance right.
But those backing the Brumbies disagree. Nikki Alberts is president of the Australian Brumby Alliance and believes a compromise was possible.
They absolutely do have a value and deserve the recognition that they had. Unfortunately, they've decided to slaughter them based on false numbers, false science. They basically walked away and rejected amendments that now mean that there will be no public consultations, no cruelty charges, no accountability if cruelty is proven, and no review of the new plan regardless of outcomes. So it's a lay-down misère to just go in and wholesale slaughter.
The fight around Brumbies has been an ugly one over the years. National park staff involved in the culling of feral horses have been repeatedly harassed, even being subjected to a firebombing threat in 2022.
It's been a long, hard fight, nearly 8 years of trying to get this law repealed.
Wiradjuri man Richard Swain is the Indigenous ambassador for the Invasive Species Council. He says it's a significant moment.
it's a momentous day because it puts respect for country above colonial mythology, and that's rare in Australia. And I'm so grateful that that has happened and that it received bipartisan support. And, you know, it's been a fantastic effort by a lot of people over many years.
The Greens' Sue Higginson supported the change and admits getting a private member's bill up is quite unusual. She's pleased to see the divisive days of the Brumby Bill are now over.
And we put this terrible era of division and hate and abuse, and that we put it behind us. We know this is Kosciuszko National Park. It's such a small part of the entire land base of New South Wales. It's a subalpine national park. It's one of our most important ecological, environmental assets. There are hundreds of thousands of hectares where we can run horses and we can have wild heritage horses if that's what we want to do. But Cozzy is precious. And it's a national park, and it requires management and legal protection for its ecological assets and its ecological values. And finally, now we can get back to doing that proper business. And now what we know is our National Parks and Wildlife Service dedicated staff and officers can now manage that park in the best way that they can. And that means being able to control invasive species.
For now, the existing management plan to retain 3,000 horses in the park will continue until at least mid-2027, but it's understood changes to feral horse management will begin after that.
Lisa Herbert reporting there. New South Wales Minister for Climate Change and the Environment, Penny Sharp, has called the scrapping of the Brumby Bill a landmark decision that will protect New South Wales' only alpine national park. Penny Sharp went on to say this bill will ensure that horses are treated the same way as other invasive species in New South Wales national parks.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company here on Australia Wide. Two caretakers of an isolated resort have shared how they survived Cyclone Fina by sheltering in an underground bunker in the far north of Western Australia. As the severe tropical cyclone crossed the remote Kimberley coast as a Category 3, Laura Stokes and Adam Zerner were directly underneath at the Berkeley River Lodge. They sheltered in an underground shipping container for over 15 hours, fearing for their lives while the luxury resort was torn apart by 170-kilometre-an-hour winds. A day after the danger had passed, the couple was evacuated to Kununurra, where they spoke to our reporter Julia Battaglia about their ordeal.
Two caretakers watch on as Fina unleashes her fury.
She's a bit rough.
From the safety of a shipping container, Adam Zerner and his partner Laura Stokes had a front row seat.
This is home for the next 24 hours.
Basically, the bunker is two shipping containers that have been welded together and buried underneath the lodge, and the lodge has been built on top of them. I thought you're kind of invincible in a steel bunker that's buried in the ground, but when it starts shaking around, I guess that changed, everything changed very quickly. I kind of thought it was just going to be, you know, a windy day and we're going to sit in there and sit in the dark and the wind will go and it'll be all good, but I guess it slowly got worse and worse and worse, and yeah, I guess I started off, I wasn't worried at all, and late into the night, I thought maybe we're going to get blown away when, you know, the vibrations and the shaking of two 20-foot containers that are buried under the ground are shaking like that. It's a lot of force to do that. It's not your average storm.
When they emerged, the landscape was vastly different.
We went into that bunker and it had been a paradise and lush in nature, and then we came out and the landscape was completely bare and obviously broken, just stuff everywhere. You know, it just felt like you're in your own apocalypse movie. It was, and of course all the alarms going off as well, just to add to it. So We knew there was damage, but we didn't expect what we saw there. And the more that we wandered on from that point, that, you know, the more of a shock. And you can see up the hill where there's like a row of seven villas, you know, and some of them were flat on the floor. And when you look closer, like, they've got no walls in them. And yeah, just devastation, really.
They were the only people in Tropical Cyclone Fina's path once he hit Western Australia. The resort closed for the off-season.
Just being with Laura together and, just hoping. I guess we were just hoping. Like, I thought we were really safe at the start, and by the end I was second-guessing how safe we actually were there.
Yeah, it was really scary. Like, there was some gusts that were so severe that I had visions of it picking up the cyclone and throwing us into the sea. You know, we were on the seaside with the sand dune, and it was like, genuinely thought there was a real possibility of being picked up and being trapped in that bunker and drowning in it.
3 out of the 18 villas have been destroyed, with the full extent of the damage still being assessed. The luxury resort is only accessible by air, and was several days before authorities could evacuate the caretakers from the site, returning to Kununurra on Wednesday.
The first couple of days just about trying to work out that you're alive and surviving, and this morning was a bit more time to reflect, and it's been really, really sad. You know, it was sad, grateful that we got rescued in the helicopter, but flying away, it was like, this has been my life here, you know, for a couple of years now, and it's a very precious place, and suddenly, you know, it's gone.
The Berkeley River Lodge had just gone through a redevelopment, and while its owners are still assessing the damage, they hope to open by the tourist season next year. For Adam Zerner and Laura Stokes, they are just grateful to have survived.
Yeah, so just trying to get to grips with them, I guess, being alive and being here, really, and seeing what will happen next.
That was Laura Stokes, one of the 2 caretakers at Berkeley River Lodge, who survived Cyclone Fina by sheltering in an underground bunker for over 15 hours. That story from our reporter Julia Battoglio. Aboriginal communities have long pushed for sovereignty of their land and peoples, with varied and evolving methods of governance in different communities around the country. Earlier this month, Victoria signed Australia's first treaty with Indigenous people, and off the coast of Tasmania, there's an island which has been running its own affairs for 2 decades. Our reporter Louise Mylan travelled from Launceston to Cape Barron for this story.
At 9 years old, Natalia Maynard knows Truana Cape Barron Island off Tasmania's north coast is special.
There's lots of free time and you can just run around the island, and it's just so fun, and you can go swimming every summer.
For Natalia's whole life, this land and the people living on it has been completely managed by the Aboriginal community. But it wasn't always like this. It's 2005, and Denise Gardner is sitting in Hobart's Parliament House as politicians debate a bill to hand Cape Barron and neighbouring Clark Island back to the Aboriginal community.
Your heart's just thumping all the time.
With just 1 vote in it,
and I support the bill.
The bill passes, and the land is returned.
Yeah, it was on from then on. Yeah, Mum was there, we were clapping, we were happy. We had a big mob waiting outside because not everyone could get in the gallery. It was just the most fantastic day.
The moment had been decades in the making.
Return of land has always been on our agenda, and especially mine. That's what my mother went for, and she was my mentor, so that's what I went for. But I believe in it, of course. You've got to believe in it. To have that warrior spirit, you know, in you. It was always like hitting blank walls, hitting walls. We were always doing that, but that just made us stronger and to keep going. So, yeah, hitting walls all the time. That we'd be loud and proud and out there, you know. Tent embassies in Hobart, and the cops would come and rip down the tents, and we'd go and find another tent somehow. We ended up having an umbrella at one stage. They even took that. But, you know, so, yeah, that's what made us a strong little community.
The islands in Bass Strait have seen some of the darkest parts of Australia's colonial history. Indigenous people have been in this area for millennia, dating back to when Tasmania was still connected to mainland Australia. But most of the population here today are descended from the children of European sealers and the Indigenous women they abducted from around Tasmania and forced onto the islands. For decades, colonial forces controlled life on Cape Barren through a mission and reserves. By the mid-1900s, governments had switched from pushing Indigenous people onto the islands to trying to force them back to mainland Tasmania to assimilate into white culture. Annette Pearden was stolen from the islands as a child.
We did a runner, but of course they caught us. Took Mum off in one plane and took me and my brother off on a different plane.
Annette was reunited with her mother as an adult and is one of many who have since returned to live on Truwana.
It's home. It'll always be home.
Today, around 80 people live here. Most are Indigenous. It's a close-knit community. One shop, a post office and houses nestled in a spot called The Corner. The closest city, Launceston, is a plane ride away. It's known just as town.
When you're in town, there's just so much cars and it's so loud, but here it's just so quiet.
The Cape Barren Island Aboriginal Association is central to the island's management. Aaron Maynard is the chair and Natalia's dad.
We own and manage everything on this island. All the infrastructure, aged care, shop, power, water.
The association receives funding from state and federal governments and works with the council on Flinders Island on matters like rubbish removal. But every decision about the place goes through the association. It manages everything from roads to housing, with rent capped at around $100 a week. Aaron says the 2005 land return was a pivotal moment, giving the community agency to manage its own affairs.
I think we had right over everything, and that's the main thing. We're not dictated by anybody but ourselves.
Kids can go to school here all the way to Year 12, though many still leave the island for more diverse opportunities. Two ranger groups help care for the land. They have programs covering everything from cat trapping to replanting kelp in the ocean. Buck Brown holds a senior role with the Truwana Rangers and practices traditional burning to manage the bush.
Yeah, you can see where it's fingered through and trickled through. Hasn't burned everything. It only burned what it needed to burn.
He says land return made it easier to implement practices like burning, fostering his connection to country.
Oh, it means a big thing. You know, especially having a younger generation that grew up on this country and back home working on their own country, you know, it's a big thing. I suppose the lesson is just keep on jumping up and down to the government and say we want our country back, our land back.
After the land return in 2005, then-Premier Paul Lennon said there'd be more to come.
We see this as a step in the right direction.
But in the 20 years since, the Tasmanian government has not made any more significant land transfers to the Aboriginal community. But on Truwana, the community is looking to the future.
We're limited to the amount of people that can come here at the moment. So more infrastructure, more housing, more people to return to Truwana.
For Aaron, the future is bright for his kids and their peers.
My son ensures me that he's not leaving till he's 27. Don't know where that number come from, but that's what he said.
And for Natalia, like the generations before her, this island will always be home.
Maybe when I grow up, I'll have to go, that I'll definitely come back.
Natalia Maynard ending that story from Louise Mylan on Truwana, Cape Barren Island.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
They've terrorised our poor sheep. They've terrorised our peacocks, chased away all our chickens.
Yeah, it's been a bit hectic. Yeah, they're reasonably commonish as far as snakes go here around the resort.
On ABC Radio.
Building a major theme park from the ground up is no easy or cheap task. There's a $2.6 billion price tag on a new attraction proposed for the rural township of Ellenbar between Brisbane and Queensland Sunshine Coast. Developers hope to have the first stage up and running before 2032 to capitalise on international tourists coming to Australia for the Olympic and Paralympic Games. But as Jessica Ross discovered, there are many potential pitfalls along the way.
Building a theme park has its ups and downs. That's one of the reasons why it's been 36 years since a new major attraction opened north of Brisbane. But plans have just been lodged for a $2.6 billion tourist and entertainment precinct at Alimba on what is currently a macadamia and strawberry farm.
Our entertainment city, the first time in Australia, we have hotel, we have theme park, entertainment centre, music centre and shopping centre all together under one umbrella. We are new generation of theme park.
Developer Ramin Amadi and his company, RHC City, have submitted the plans to Moreton Bay Regional Council. The development would be built across 68 hectares, surrounded by farmland and forestry, in the rural township just south of the Sunshine Coast. The plans show a giant dome in the centre, which is actually a 9,000-seater city hall, an amusement park out the back, a water park out the front, a 700-room hotel, and several promenades featuring scaled-down versions of world-famous landmarks, including the Statue of Liberty.
We are focusing about world heritage. We have the landmark from US, we have landmark from Europe, we have landmark from Italy, France, you know, everywhere. And you come into our city, you can feel in different parts of the world.
Mr. Amadi says he wants the park to be a permanent world expo and plans for Stage 1 to be built in time for the 2032 Games. But first, the council needs to approve the development and the support of residents will be crucial.
Look, it will change the face of Alimba very strongly. And, you know, I look at it, I drive around our streets now, and one of the things that makes the area really attractive is that look and that feel of a small country community that values its farming and its lifestyle.
Jason Smith is a local and has been involved in community discussions about the project and says many residents can see the benefits too.
It's going to have to be investment in all aspects of local infrastructure that the developer's going to have to provide. And you can either have something big that comes in and be involved in making sure that it's the right, you know, that it's developed the right way to suit the community and the area, or you can, you know, take the opposite side of the fence, in which case then you don't have any control over how something gets developed.
But construction costs could blow out. According to Senior Lecturer in Tourism, Dr. Aaron Tham from the University of the Sunshine Coast.
Clearly, the demands on raw materials, labour and other costs going into the build is always going to be promising, but also at the same time challenging if there are delays in there. Once we have extreme weather conditions or other delays to supply, then it could push potentially closer to a 3 billion mark based on the timelines. And that's what we're seeing already from infrastructure build towards the Olympics. It's not so much of getting the place up and running, but also the amount of economic viability to keep the place afloat. And many of the projects in the last few years have continued to be challenged by this because of rising costs of operations, labour charges, food charges and so on.
Aussie World was the last park to open in 1989, but others have tried. A water and theme park was proposed for Glenview, near Australia Zoo, but the company, Sanad Capital, went into liquidation. A Kelly Slater surf park proposed further north at Coolum got wiped out after community backlash. Another surf park with artificial waves has been approved for the Glasshouse Mountains, but construction's yet to start. Mr. Amadi is adamant. Infinity Planet is more than just a pipe dream. Will it happen?
Definitely. I am, as a CEO of this company, I promise to the people this should be happen. And we are planning more than 3 years. But we need the local people help us to make this project happen.
That's Infinity Planet CEO Ramin Amadi. Ending that report by Jessica Ross. And finally here on Australia-wide. In regional Western Victoria, many local residents have to travel long distances to access primary healthcare or even a pharmacist. Farming communities are even more affected, with many missing out on vaccinations due to their remoteness. But in the northwest Victorian town of Oyen, 100 kilometres south of Mildura, pharmacist Alex Look is set on changing this. Now he's being celebrated for his contribution to his local community after winning an International Pharmacist of the Year award for going the extra mile. Grace Marshall has this report.
When residents of the northwest Victorian town of Oyen stop by their local pharmacy,
they know they are getting much more than just their prescription filled. The pharmacy is not only your one-stop shop for medical supplies, it's also a community hub full of connection, and that is due in large part to owner Alex Look. With a population of just over 1,000, most people in Oyen are familiar with Alex, who finds his work in regional Victoria more rewarding than that of the city or larger metropolitan areas.
I think that the practice of pharmacy here is much more rewarding than anywhere else I could ever possibly do. So that's one thing I feel is unique about here is my ability to do good work as a pharmacist.
Alex says the relationship between community pharmacists and their patients was not just transactional, but often unique and special. And it's not just those who are local to Oyen who see Alex, with people travelling from all over Western Victoria.
We are seeing people probably within about an hour's radius, so about 100 kilometres in all directions. And in fact, some of our services are people are travelling from larger towns, such as Mildura, to come specifically to us. So, for example, sleep apnea services, we're doing that and we're reaching patients within Mildura. Because our wait time is less and we're more flexible with the way that we can deliver services. So we're seeing patients from all over the state and sometimes in South Australia as well, coming across the border to access some of our pharmacist-led services.
In early November, Mr. Look was awarded International Pharmacist of the Year by the Pharmacy Innovation Assembly in Melbourne. The award recognises pharmacists from diverse backgrounds who are making meaningful and lasting impacts on the profession. Mr. Look said it was an honour to be recognised for the pharmacy's contribution to the community.
So fantastic. I think we're quite innovative in our industry and in our town. We've been recognised quite a few times nationally for different projects we're doing. So this is just an extra nice a recognition, I guess, from the Pharmacy Innovation Assembly.
Mr. Look believes that small regional towns should receive the same level of healthcare as those in the city or larger regional centres.
We always remind them that we shouldn't be second-class citizens just because we live in a rural town. We deserve access to high-quality medications and care.
Earlier in the year, Mr. Look introduced Q Fever vaccination services to the pharmacy. Q Fever is a disease caused by bacteria which spreads from cattle, sheep and goats, as well as other domestic and wild animals, to humans. Mr. Look said accessing the vaccination had been difficult for people in Oyen, which is known for its grain and livestock farming.
With the Q fever, a lot of our region is based in agriculture, farming with livestock and also farming the land. And this increases people's risk of Q fever, which is endemic within Victoria. What we realised is that this type of process to get this vaccination done wasn't so straightforward. So it's not just like you go to the clinic once and have your vaccination. You actually need to go through several layers of testing. So we were finding that people were travelling up to 6 hours commuting just to get this vaccination in the end. And we wanted to improve the access because a lot of people weren't getting the vaccination because of the time taken to get the testing done.
Working as a pharmacist in a regional town has its rewards, but it also has its challenges, with people accessing services during times of crisis and need.
The fact that they can come in at any time without an appointment and discuss a wide range of issues, joys and troubles at the same time, it's really powerful. And also because there's no stigma associated with our business, because we are used for a variety of purposes, people come to the pharmacy for all sorts of reasons. They can access care and a range of other facilities all in the same spot, and no one will know any different why they're here, whether they're here for a script or vaccination or to talk about some problems at home or to get some advice on cosmetics or beauty or whatnot. So we do a range of things, which is really cool.
Before moving to Oyen, Mr. Look had worked in various locations, including in Western Australia, Queensland, Broken Hill and Mildura. He said moving to Oyen was the best decision he had ever made, and it's the community's drive that inspired him.
Honestly, I must say that moving to Oyen has been the best decision I've ever made. Like, it has been so incredible. And I think that often pharmacists or people in general have some concerns about going to small towns, about what they can do or making friends or whatnot. But in fact, my experience has been incredible. And even as a person of diverse background, which is what this award was about specifically, it was about diversity as a pharmacist going and being in a rural area. I've had nothing but positive experiences, and I really hope that other people can give it a chance, because if they come to a small town and embrace it and get involved, they would actually really, I'm confident they'll really love living here as well.
Grace Marshall reporting there on internationally recognised pharmacist Alex Look. And that is Australia-wide for this week. A big thank you to Lisa Herbert for production duties. I'm Alex Hyman. Thanks so much for your company. Have a wonderful weekend. Cheerio.
Say listen.